Kids Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. On the long list of things I will never do is ride a bike or run 1,000 miles to Nome. But competitors will soon be setting off on the Iditarod Trail Invitational to do that, and some may do it faster than the dog mushers. Closer to town, the Susitna 100 has its own community of competitors who bike, ski, or run through the wilderness for 100 miles, taking on whatever the elements can dish out. Alaskans like to do crazy things, and few are as crazy as these ultramarathon races that allow you to choose your mode of transportation. On today's show, I'll be talking to organizers of both races, learning the history, the kinds of people involved, and what it takes to put on or compete in one of these races. And we'll touch on technology. Fat bikes were invented by competitors in these races, which have become a proving ground for lightweight winter gear. My first guest is Katie Merchant, and she is the race director for the Iditarod Trail Invitational, which is this amazing race which takes place every year, basically crossing a large portion of Alaska. And it's a long tradition, and it's become a real proving ground for new technology. You know, one of our great Alaska inventions is the fat tire bike. Well, this is kind of where it came from. So for the first half of the show, I'm going to be talking to Katie about the race, which is coming up, and a lot of other events that they have planned around it. Obviously, we are not all capable of participating in a race like this, but there is some other stuff you may be interested in. Thanks for being with me, Katie.
Glad to be on the show.
And you are now down in sunny Utah, because we're pre-recording way before the race starts, partly because I bet you're going to be really, really busy as this thing moves closer. It must be a huge project putting on this race.
It is a big project, and I just returned a couple of days ago from one of our qualifier events. I just raced 125 miles in Island Park, Idaho. I was on a bike for 32 hours, and then I was up for over 40 hours. So I just finished that, and I'm actually going to be up in Alaska on Friday this week. We'll be back in Alaska.
Okay.
But, I've been planning the other events since April, and to get all the logistics set up for the race. We always start doing that by October, November.
Uh-huh.
Call people in, start writing checks and pay people on the trail, and I send updates to the racers and get all my permits and all this stuff in place. So it's a lot of work, but it's a huge passion for Bill and I to put on this race.
Yeah, your husband, Bill Merchant, who's one of the founders. So let's tell people who don't know, just what is the Iditarod Trail Invitational? I mean, what is it? What are the distances, and what's all involved?
It's a winter ultra endurance event on the historic Iditarod Trail, the same trail that the dog mushers use in the wintertime. And the trail only exists in the wintertime. It in places, it's swamps and rivers and lakes. It doesn't even exist in the summer. We use the same trail. We have cyclists, fat bikes, and we have runners, and we have skiers in the event. We have 130 miles to Winter Lake Lodge, 350 miles to McGrath, and of course the 1,000 miles all the way to Nome. That's the longest distance we offer. That's the entire Iditarod Trail.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Competitors total. In total, we have 70 competitors.
So you limit it to that, and it's invitational because obviously this is not an easy race, and it's potentially a very hazardous race. So you want to screen the people who enter.
Right. So over the years, there are a lot of racers that have come up to Alaska for many years have started their own events in other states and even in other countries. We have six qualifiers, the Sioux 100, the White Mountains 100, the Arrowhead in Minnesota, the Rovaniemi in Finland, the Fat Pursuit in Idaho, and the Tuscobia Ultra in Wisconsin. And people have to have a minimum of two qualifiers that they have completed before they get accepted into this race. Or they can do our annual five-day winter training camp where we make them sleep outside for four nights in a row in their sleeping bag. They got to boil water, use a stove, make their own food. They learn about how to repair their bikes and do all those things, build a fire, all the important skills it takes to be safe out there in the wintertime. So we are very selective about the people that get into this event because it's very remote, and they have to be self-sufficient on the trail. Sometimes they have to cover 50 or 80 miles before they reach the next checkpoint.
Right. So, I mean, in that sense, it's like a wilderness experience. There's not much of a safety net. You're not holding their hands as they do this. They really have to be outdoors folks who can get by on their own, and also be athletes who can cover really large distances through potentially very cold, rugged conditions.
That's right. They have to be self-sufficient, and we want to offer this as an adventure to people. We don't have a crew of snow machines that will check on them regularly. And another safety net is the next racer behind them. That's our safety net, and of course the checkpoints, and we do keep track of them. If they are overdue in a checkpoint, then we would definitely send someone to look for them. But to make it safer and for peace of mind for us, we require those qualifiers, and we're very selective about who gets to race. And we've had really good luck with that in the last few years.
So I imagine most people don't go all the way to Nome. I mean, that's sort of one of those supreme things to have accomplished, to go 1,000 miles by human power. What is the distance that most people go after?
It's the 350. That's the big. Our biggest event is the 350-mile event. Since the year 2000, 2000 was the first year when the race went all the way to Nome. Back then it was called the Iditarod Sport Impossible, but it became possible, and there was a record of 15 days that stood for a long time. The record to Nome now is 10 days on a bike. That's 100 miles a day.
Incredible.
That record was set just a couple of years ago by Jeff Oatley from Fairbanks. Since then, we've had about 50 people, I believe, that have done the 1,000-mile distance.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. There's a lot of people have done it twice. There's a few that have done it three times. And we have a runner, Tim Hewitt, who has done it 9 times.
Incredible. It just blows my mind that a human being can even do that, because you're actually running through the snow, pulling a sled with all your gear, and covering multiple marathon distances daily, really, to get it done. And
to make it a little harder, Tim Hewitt, a few years back, he had all his own fuel and all his own food. That year, he didn't go inside a single checkpoint and carried everything he needed to walk to Nome in 24 days. He carried everything he needed for that entire time.
Incredible. Just amazing. You know, nobody, back in the past, nobody thought these things were possible. I mean, when Joe Reddington started the Iditarod sled dog race, just mushing to Nome was thought to be a pretty amazing accomplishment. And it took them, you know, more than 3 weeks to get there. And now you've got people doing it on bikes and on foot in less time. It's extraordinary how we keep amazing ourselves with what human beings are capable of. And you guys are kind of in the forefront of that, right? I mean, you must be constantly amazed at what these people are capable of.
It's pretty incredible. I would say they're the best winter ultra athletes in the world to do that human powered, to go those distances, spend that many hours in the saddle or on their feet to get there. They in 24 hours, they might sleep a couple of hours. So they're on the move for 20 hours straight. And they do it day after day after day. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, amazing. So let's talk about the sort of the history of the Iditarod Trail Invitational. It started out before fat tire bikes had been invented, and they kind of got invented because of the race. But going back to before that, it was sort of started as like a multi-sport race, right? You could cycle, you could snowshoe, you could ski, you could run. And in the early years, as I recall, it was sort of a not known like which sport was going to win. And it's evolved since then to become more of a bike race. What's sort of the original genesis of this race?
Originally, Joe Reddington Sr. encouraged human-powered endurance events on the Iditarod Trail just to keep the trail and the tradition in Alaska alive. There was a snowshoe race. I did a ski, and the first I did a bike was in 1987. And of course, there was no fat rims or tires. People used regular mountain bikes and rode them in the snow. And then over the years, they were trying to find a wider footprint, to find bigger tires, wider rims. There was even rims that were welded together, and there was a bike called the six-pack that Roger Cowles rode, and it was three rims welded together just to get a wider track on the snow. And since then, they have evolved into these fat bikes, and they have become really, really popular all over the country and overseas as well. And
once those came about, then there was really no way for a skier to keep up, right? I mean, the fat bikes on these, the snow is fairly well packed. A fat bike is gonna be faster.
They can average 10 miles an hour. I would say if the conditions are good, a skier could keep up with that. But the problem is that there's often sections, there's very little snow. It could be rutted and icy snow. Or when it's really cold, and often it is in the interior, there's no glide on skis. So that's when the bikes, they definitely have an advantage. It's been the fastest mode of transportation out there. And we've been setting records the last 3 years on the course. In fact, the fastest time right now is as fast as the dog mushers.
Yeah, that's really something.
To McGrath, in the first 350 miles, it was under 2 days. It was 1 day and 18 hours and 32 minutes.
Amazing. So how did it, the race has been through different incarnations since the early days when it was started in the Adidas Sport and so on. And I guess your husband, Bill, has been involved all the way back to the 90s. How has it changed identities over the years in terms of who's running the race and how it's set up?
Dan Bull was the early organizer of the Adidas Sport. In fact, there was four guys that rode to Nome in 1989, and he was one of those guys. And then he brought Adidas Sport to life. I did a bike and I did a sport. He called it Adidas Sport when all the different disciplines on foot, ski, and bike were merged into one event in 1991.
Oh, I see.
And there was some problems with the event, and racers asked Bill, who was in the race as a competitor, to take over the race and to continue it. And he changed the name to the Iditarod Trail Invitational. At that time, Adidas Sport had a bad reputation out on the trail with the lodges and checkpoints, and he didn't want to continue with that name, so he called it the Invitational.
It just got a little bit disorganized?
Yeah, there was problems with drop bags and mm-hmm. other things. But the race itself has continued under the Invitational name since then. The only change that was done was a mandatory overnight at Flathorn Lake. We don't do that anymore. When the race starts, the clock starts, and it doesn't finish until they either, you know, reach McGrath or Nome, or now in the 130-mile distance until they reach Winter Lake Lodge.
So if you want to go straight through and not rest, then
yeah,
you...
The old format had a mandatory overnight at Flathorn Lake to test and make sure people had the right equipment with them. We don't need that anymore because we have all these qualifiers and people get to do the qualifiers. You know, the Arrowhead can be very cold in Minnesota. They often have had minus 35, and the qualifiers have been a great, great addition. Because before, where would people go and learn about how to do these sort of events? And now they have all these qualifiers. They can do two or three of those, and they learn a tremendous amount, and they're much better prepared by the time they come and do this race.
Uh-huh, yeah. So, and now the race is it's a for-profit business that you run, and it's sort of part of your lifestyle is doing guiding down to Utah and then coming back to Alaska. And so you've got it sort of on a very stable footing, and you're kind of introducing new people to long-distance events.
Right. I would say that my lifestyle and my business very much revolves around cycling. I race in the summertime. I do stage racing. I raced in Costa Rica. And in November, I just did the Fat Pursuit, which is one of our qualifiers in Idaho. When I'm not in the winter, in the summertime, we guide people on mountain biking. And that's how I make my living, is organizing this event, guiding people, and if I find the time, then I do other races myself. So my life pretty much revolves around cycling and fat biking in the wintertime in particular. It's been a great thing that I found when I moved to Alaska in 2002.
Yeah, I guess so. It's Outdoor Explorer. My name is Charles Wolforth, and we're talking about these super races that we have in Alaska, covering distance over the snow. And right now we're talking about the Iditarod Trail Invitational with Katie Merchant, who's the race director. She's in Utah as we're pre-recording now, so that we can kind of get her thoughts before she gets into the thick of running this thing and getting it all put together. And it's going to be coming up quite soon. So, Katie, you have some other events planned in advance of the actual race start. Tell us a little bit about what your other events are that are going to be going on.
We have some events planned in Anchorage, and over the years we have a large fan base that primarily follows the event on Facebook. And we started using track leaders to have live tracking on the racers last year. And I wanted to bring the event into Anchorage, where locals could come and experience and meet the racers. We have guest speakers. So what I did is I have a Fat Bike convention at the Egan Center February 26th and the 27th, and we'll be showing a film. Like I said, we have guest speakers. There'll be vendors there with different fat bike brands, tires and rims and accessories. And also for Saturday, February 27th, we are planning a big fat ride, a celebration of fat biking in Anchorage. And this will be during Fur Rondi, where we will start in downtown and have a ride where any rider on a fat bike can show up, any ability, and just to celebrate fat biking in Alaska, because I feel very strongly it was the birthplace of the fat bike.
Yeah, and I guess they'll get to meet some of the sort of top athletes and maybe ask some questions and learn something.
Once they go out on the Iditarod Trail, it's remote. You know, nobody gets to see those folks anymore. It'll be a way for fans to they can meet the racers, they can check out their bikes, look at their gear, they can ask them questions. I think it's going to be a great event for anyone that is interested in the event to see everything firsthand.
Uh-huh. And then when does the race actually start?
The race will start on Sunday, February 28th at 2 o'clock at Kinnick Lake.
Okay.
Just outside of Wasilla.
And I'm sure you've got information on your website, which we will have linked from our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show and you will find all that information to learn about the Iditarod Trail Invitational and the different events that are happening. You were talking, Katie, about how fat tire bikes were really born on the Iditarod Trail as people were trying to become more competitive in this race. Is it still a technology testing ground as manufacturers are, you know, improving these bikes? And obviously there must be competition at the top end to, like, have the best fat tire bike. Do you see new stuff introduced all the time out there on the trail?
It still is. Just a couple of years ago, carbon bikes started entering the market. Where bikes used to weigh 32 pounds, now they can be as light as 22 pounds. And in fact, we'll have a fat bike history display at the Egan Center, and I'm bringing up Ray Molina from New Mexico, who had the first 82 millimeter rims produced in Mexico. They were called the Ray Molina rims. That's still a standard. There's a lot of 80 millimeter rims. There's many companies that make rims and different tires. There's a Clown Shoe. There's a 4.8 tire now. There's 100 millimeter rims. The question is, what is too big, where the rolling resistance is more than the float that you get on the snow? It depends on the conditions. They're trying to get the bikes lighter, you know, and then the different tires and rims and rolling resistance. And last year we had a lot of ice on the course where a lot of people had studded tires. I would say that technology does play a part in it, but I think our athletes have gotten more experience too. It's a combination of both, I think. And the fact that we've, in the last 2 years, we had super hard trails and we had the best athletes on the best bikes out there, I think that's what made it possible to have that amazing record, or two records, both the male and female record to McGrath and the amazing record to Nome, the 10 days to Nome. That's just really amazing. But it has certainly a lot to do with the technology and the tires and rims, and everything is getting lighter, and And of course, there's always new products on the market, and I think that's what the potential for the expo is, for the companies that are making the boots and are making the rims and tires, and you know, they need sleeping bags and stoves and all the gear that racers carry. I think there's a huge potential for companies to get the word out there about their new products as well.
And it's really taken off and spread all over the country and probably over the all over the world. Last summer, I was seeing fat tire bikes on the beaches on the East Coast, which totally surprised me.
Yeah, there's actually three or four fat bike brands in Australia. They ride them on the beaches and on the sand. And there's many makers of frame bags and pogies and seat post bags, all the ways of carrying your gear. It's created a huge market for those products. Where in the past, when I moved to Alaska, you know, we were looking in cross-country skiing and we were looking for different boots. We had to look in other departments to find and modify the things that we needed to ride a bike in those temperatures. Where today there's companies like 45 North that makes those boots and tires, and they specifically make things for winter cycling.
Yeah, it's customized, and it's... Yeah, it's really fun to see a whole new sport really be born and watch it, this sort of rapid advance of the technology, which I suppose will probably plateau at some point, but it still seems to be advancing pretty quickly right now. I'm interested in, obviously, the elite, the very, very best cyclists, their biggest, most important tool is their fitness and their cycling ability. But what always seems to happen at the top of elite sports is that you'll have people who are very closely matched, who have extraordinary fitness and ability, and then they'll start trying to get a tiniest little edge with their equipment. And do you see people like trying to choose exactly the right tires and wheels for the conditions? Do you see people making adjustments like that? Or do you kind of have to, is everybody pretty equal when they start out in terms of their equipment?
I think we've been going through trends. They went back to skinnier for a while when the 29 was really big. Now there's 29 plus. There's plus size right now.
So that's
now.
The wheel size, the 29er, it's a big wheel. And so they're,
right,
yeah.
Right. Now there's a plus size, which is there's 27 and a half and then plus, which is that size and plus a wider rim. There's so many different sizes now, and I'm sure people will show up with all different bikes. And depending on the conditions, but, you know, the conditions can always change. We can get a foot of snow overnight, and their plans are completely different.
Right. If you chose a narrow wheel, then you're really in trouble.
In 2012, we started the race, and we got a foot of snow overnight. And where the racers usually arrive at Squinton Roadhouse at around midnight, it took them 2 days to get there. It was unbelievable. It didn't matter then if you had skinny tires or white tires or plus size, or everybody was just walking in a pace line, pushing their bike along. And I think they made it as far as the edge of the Susitna River that night.
Wow.
Which is not very far at all.
Yeah, really.
Alaska still has the upper hand in this. And if we get a lot of snow or, you know, a big windstorm, then the trail can be gone, and everybody's in the same boat. Everybody's walking along and slowing down. It's just a matter of the weather and the conditions that plays a huge, huge part in this race. And that's why you can never compare the records or the finishing times, because the winner has done it under 2 days, and we've had years where the winner did one in 5 days.
Yeah. Well, have people started to pare down their survival equipment and try to go very, very light because of these super fast times? I mean, if you're only on the trail for 2 days, then that's quite different than if you're on the trail for potentially a week. You'd pack differently, I would think. And I wonder if that's a trend that you've seen.
Yeah, that's the scary part for us, because they think that, oh, wow, I don't need all this other stuff. I'm going to leave it at home next year. Because then next year there could be a completely different year and they would need all that gear. We don't have a mandatory gear list. We don't do any checks for what gear they carry, because we feel that when they do this race, they already need to know what they need out there. And so the scary part is that some of the elite racers think they can get away without you know, some of that gear. And I think that's where the danger is of these three good years that we've had, is people say, oh, I don't need this, I don't need that, I'm going to be in McGrath in 2 days. And they just need to keep in mind that, you know, we can have a real winter with a lot of snow and 40 below, and they need to be prepared for that. If they can't move forward, they need to be prepared to bivvy out and hunker down and stay put, or it might take them 5 days, not 2 days, to get somewhere.
Right. It could be life-threatening kind of situation out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the veterans, you know, we have people that have been doing this for 6, 8, and 10 years. They know that because they have seen that. They have been out there in those years. But we have racers that have done the race the last 2 years, and they think, oh, I've got it all figured out. But they're in for a big surprise if we have another year like 2012.
That's right. So, tell me about the skiers and the runners. I guess the snowshoers probably went by the boards many years ago. You still have some runners, very few skiers.
Very few skiers. A lot of our runners carry snowshoes. And in 2012, those snowshoes came in really handy.
There you go.
And the runners passed up the bikers very quickly.
but they're kind in different race, right? I mean, the runners aren't trying to beat the bikers. That would be impossible.
It could be possible. In 2012, a runner was the first one into Rhone, 200 miles into the race.
Because he wasn't trying to push a bike.
Yeah, he was on foot and he had snowshoes. But then, of course, usually from Rhone on, it's in the rain shadow of the Alaska Range. There's usually not a lot of snow. And that's where the bikers passed him up. So it's possible, but not likely, that a runner would beat a biker to McGrath. But it's possible.
I suppose probably the runners are competing against the other runners, right?
They're competing heads up. In fact, we have an amazing runner from Willow, Alaska, David Johnston.
Oh, he is amazing. He's been on the show. Yeah, incredible man.
He ran to McGrath in just over 4 days. That's 82 miles a day.
Incredible.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, amazing.
Really
a human being
incredible.
Could do that.
Then, really incredible.
And then he ran all the way to Fairbanks the next summer. So
he's definitely part sled dog, I'm convinced.
I think so, yeah. And the thing I've noticed is that he's got the most positive attitude, which I guess you'd have to have if you could take that kind of suffering, to just be totally cheerful all the time.
He's always cheerful, and I know he's hurting, and you can't tell. He's really amazing.
Yeah. And skiers are sort of not really part of it anymore. You might get one every now and then, but for the most part, they're not doing the race anymore. True?
We do have a skier on the roster, and I have I can look here. I'm hoping we'll have a skier finish here this year or maybe next year.
Uh-huh.
It just depends on the conditions.
And do you ever participate, Katie? I mean, you've done the race before, right?
Yep, I've done the race 3 times. I did the race, the 350 in 2005 and 2006, and then I was the first woman to bike to Nome in 2008.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm really proud of that fact. And I would say after 2008, the race became so popular that I really had to focus on the organizational part, and I decided not to race anymore and make this a great event. But I'm very glad I had the opportunity to ride 1,000 miles to Nome with my husband, Bill, in 2008. It was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, that's something that you can definitely point to all your life as being a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that. And I think a lot of race directors should do their own race sometime.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of races out there, but you know when racers talk to me and it says, yep, I've been there and done that. I know exactly what you're talking about, you know.
Yeah, great. Well, wonderful. I'm really excited to watch the race go out this year, the Iditarod Trail Invitational. Been talking to Katie Merchant, who is the race director, and they've got a lot of interesting events that the public can get involved in prior to the start of the race. You can find out the dates and all the information about those by going to our website, alaskapublic.org, and following the link to Katie's website. Thanks so much for being with us today, Katie.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Great. So it's Outdoor Explorer. My name's Charles Woolforth. Please stay with us.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Now for the second half of the show, we are talking about another amazing race, one that's been going on quite a while, called the Susitna 100. It has a couple of different events. It's going to be taking place shortly, and I have one of the organizers, Aaron Kittredge, who helps run the race. It runs out of Big Lake, and another running, biking, skiing event, which I think must be something that's fairly unique to Anchorage, right, or to Alaska, Aaron? I'm not sure that they do this a lot of other places.
Nope, it does seem to be unique to Alaska.
Yeah. So just tell me about the Susitna 100. What is it, and where does it go, and the dates and stuff like that?
Okay. The Susitna 100, we've been around since the early 90s. We've had a couple renditions, but we've been the Susitna 100 for quite a few years now. So it is a bike, foot, and ski race. You can do any of those disciplines. We don't require that you declare your division until race day, so you can sit at home and look out the window and see what the weather's like and decide that day. If it snows a foot, you might change your mind about what you're going to use.
But, oh, cool.
And it starts at Big Lake at Martin Boozer's Happy Trails Kennel. He's been wonderful about opening up his visitor center for us to have that as the race headquarters start and finish. And then it goes out 100 miles through dog mushing trails, through ski trails. Most of them are groomed out onto the river. It goes up by Deshka Landing and then back. We also have the Little Sioux 50K, which is 50 kilometers, and it starts and finishes at Martin's. It starts on the same day, and it's a 12-hour, so again, bike, ski, run, and you just go out, and there's a nice little loop for you to do that. A lot of people get their feet wet in the Little Sioux 50 and then come back the next year to do the 100.
And 50, I mean, you could probably, I mean, certainly do it way less than 12 hours if you're a... Right. I mean, if 12 hours is like the limit to it, or how does that work?
Yes, yes. There's the cutoff time is 12 hours, but yeah, absolutely. Most people finish. It kind of just depends on race conditions, you know. If it snows a bunch, it kind of changes everything for everyone but skiers.
Right.
This year we have far fewer skiers than we have in years past just because of the snow or lack thereof in Anchorage. So training has been difficult for everyone. But right now the course is in good shape, surprisingly good shape. They've got about 2 or 3 inches of snow over the past couple of weeks, so it's in good condition for all disciplines.
Yeah, and we're pre-recording a couple of weeks ahead, so things always change
That's
in Alaska.
True.
But but the show is airing just a few days ahead of the race. So, but there is still a chance for people to do some last minute registration, right?
Absolutely. So we have our registration closed February 5th. And at our pre-race meeting, we have a mandatory pre-race meeting for the 100-miler, and it is at the First United Methodist Church downtown tonight at 6 o'clock, or excuse me, on the 11th at 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sign up there. That's our last chance. The 50K has been sold out since September. That sells out within a matter of hours. It's very popular.
Wow. It must be fun, challenging, rewarding to run something that's so popular and that so many people want to be involved in, but at the same time, probably a lot of work.
It is a lot of work, but I can't say enough about our racers and our volunteers. I mean, we've had the same crew for years. I mean, I've been involved myself just for probably the last 15 years as a cheerleader, a board member, race organizer, volunteer. We get the same people every year. The checkpoints that we have, we've had to change the course a few times over the years, and every checkpoint that gets involved, can't wait to do it again next year. Our racers are just have a really, really good time. I mean, even this year, so far we've got 145 racers, and 76 of them are veterans, you know, so people come back year after year, and even though there's more and more races, this one's just very popular.
Yeah, for the 100-miler?
Yeah, for the 100-miler. And then the 50K, like I said, that's kind of a training ground for some. So we have 73 rookies and 52 vets, and that's maxed out at 125. We do cap that one.
Yeah. So, I mean, the 50K, I can kind of imagine, because I've done the tour of Anchorage and I've done the Sonat up in Fairbanks. And you know, there's some other races around Alaska at 50K. 100 miles sounds pretty daunting. When I think of the Iditarod Trail Invitational, that seems crazy, right? Like 350 miles or 1,000 miles.
It is daunting.
Yeah, I mean, that's not even human. But, I mean, it seems like 100 miles is really, really tough. And how do people do that? I mean, do they sleep halfway along the way? Do they just go straight through? What's the sort of, give me a sense of what that really means to do a 100-mile race.
I think it's kind of if you're a racer or an adventurer, right? So the racers on bikes, they just power through, and they just get it done. And sometimes it doesn't take them, you know, 19 hours. It doesn't take them very long.
Depending on the snow, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and even David Johnston, a runner, he's done it in far less. I mean, he just powers through.
We had him on the radio with us talking about that, and he set an amazing record. But he's somebody whose physical abilities just boggle the mind. It seems almost impossible for somebody to do some of the stuff he does. And so he just sets out and runs. Yeah.
Yeah, and then turns around and does the Iditarod Invitational.
Yeah, incredible.
He's a unique individual.
For
and
sure.
Smiling the whole way. But that's the thing. A lot of our racers are just that. They've got the mental fortitude to just be happy and just power through. But, you know, we have checkpoints probably, you know, every 12 to 15 miles. We have a checkpoint that you can, you know, get warm if you want to, get food, you can sleep. So, you know, even though it is like it's a supported race. You have to have your own equipment. We have mandatory gear so you can survive by yourself for 2 days if you needed to. But, you know, you've got that support that in 15 miles I'm going to have a checkpoint and I can go get my, you know, change my clothes or get myself mentally prepared for the next 15 miles. So.
Yeah, have a bowl of soup and warm up and, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And talk to the other racers and get re-energized and out you go again. Because it's 48 hours, though, the weather can truly change. I mean, we've had it where you started and it was 20 below, and somewhere during those 2 days, you know, it warmed up to 40 above. You know, that is the other challenge of a multi-stage race or multi-day race, that things can change in Alaska, especially lately.
Yeah, you really don't know what could happen. You could be out there in the rain, and that could be a whole different challenge. Yeah.
Yeah, those are the worst races because hypothermia is so dangerous when it gets warm and wet.
Mm-hmm. So, have you done the race yourself?
I have not.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I'm much better on the sidelines. I think those people are crazy.
There you go.
I think all of our board members, or most of our board members, have done it, and a lot of our volunteers do. You know, if they've had an injury or they haven't had good training, they always want to come back and help volunteer. So, like I said, we've just had people been with the race for a long time, yeah. And every year we get to add new people, both as racers and volunteers, so it just makes for a nice mix.
Well, and you've seen a lot of racers go through checkpoints, and you mentioned David Johnston's amazing positive attitude, which I figure has got to be, besides having an amazing body, you couldn't do it unless you had this positive attitude. And I wonder if doing these long-distance races, kind of the frame of mind might be sort of the secret weapon. You know, I was talking to a racer, I think he did the White Mountain 100, which is another, you know, long race up in the Fairbanks area. And he said, well, he came into the last checkpoint and his competitor came in, they'd been skiing together, you know, they're both exhausted, and they had a bite to eat, and then his competitor asked for a bowl of soup, and he got up and left, and that's when the race was over, because he knew that he would win, because the other guy just really needed another bowl of soup. And I wonder if you've seen that kind of thing in terms of, like, it's the competitive instinct and also just sort of the positive attitude that gets people through, or what does get people through?
I think it's funny that you say that. We have this joke about checkpoints are not your friend, because you get in there and they're warm, and there's food, and everybody's so friendly and having a good time. You know, sometimes the checkpoint people, you know, they decorate and they're silly and they just have a really good time. But if you're wanting to get going, you don't want to get too comfortable. So that is a danger, that the checkpoints are very warm and inviting.
I know.
If you're racing, you want to get in and get out. But I have often wondered that. Like I said, I've been involved with the race for 15 years, and that we've just never had a stinker, not once. And I thought, how does that happen? Well, I think it's what you said. You have to have that mental attitude that can do. It might be getting crummy this leg of the race, but I'm going to be fine when I'm over. And, you know, you just have to have that kind of that mental attitude to get you through. Or otherwise, you couldn't do it. I mean, we all know our bodies can do anything we make them do, but you've got to get your mind to tell it to do it.
Right. And it's also recreation. I mean, no one's making you do this. So if you'd rather stay in town and watch a football game, you can, right? So
that's right.
But those aren't the guys who are out there doing it.
Do this.
Guys and women, yeah.
And we do. We have, you know, we have the super athletes, and we have just what I would call everyday people that really just amaze me. They just want to get out and give it a whirl and see how it goes and what they can do. So I won't say it's for everybody. I mean, you have to know what you're doing so you don't get hurt. But, it's amazing that not everybody out there is a super athlete. But the fact that they finish, they're athletes. You know, they are super athletes in that regard.
Yeah, and really something to call your own, a real accomplishment where you say, well, I did a 100-mile race, and most people will be pretty impressed with that.
And in the dark and in the wilderness, I think that would be what would be very challenging for me. Sometimes you're out there and you're all by yourself, and you've never seen dark like that or quiet like that. That's a mental adjustment you have to make, too, that you're just out there solo. It's like being on the moon.
Yeah, yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer, and today we're talking about these long-distance races we have in Alaska where you can bike, ski, or run, which I think are kind of a unique thing. I've never heard about them anywhere else. Maybe they happen other places, but here it's a real thing, and it's had a lot of impact. You know, this is where fat bikes got invented, was to do these races, which are now being manufactured all over the country and used all over the world. And a lot of innovation takes place out there on the trail. So right now we're talking with Aaron Kittredge, who's an organizer of the Susitna 100 and a race which is getting started in just a few days here. I'm interested in the evolution of the technology. When you started working with the race, Aaron, I guess the bikers didn't always win, right? Because you were just on regular mountain bikes, and a lot of times the snow would be too deep and the bike just turns into a hindrance. It's something you have to lug along, whereas the skiers might be doing really well, and other years the runners would win. And now I'm guessing probably the bikers are pretty much almost always going to win because they've got the fat tire bikes.
Yeah, pretty much. But like you said, we have had years that the skiers won. We've had competitive skiers come from other countries and ski it. We had a team from, it was Germany that came, and they were phenomenal.
Wow.
We had an Olympic team from some other country a few years ago that came. And but yeah, it is pretty much the bikers that win it now. But again, like you said, you get some fresh snow out there, and it is pretty much you're taking your bike for a walk, for a long walk.
Uh-huh.
And that's when you see them come in the checkpoint, and they're just spent because they have been post-holing and pushing, and it's not so much fun, and then the skiers buzz through and are smiling the whole way. So, but we have seen over the years, in fact, we've got pictures of the first imagination bike, fat bikes, you know, where they had two tires next to each other or a bike with a ski on it, and people have tried everything.
Wow.
But yeah, it you look back in the pictures, and it wasn't that long ago that fat bikes weren't around. Everybody's out there with, you know, 1-inch tires or 2-inch tires, and those were fun times. And that was when we had a lot more snow, it seems.
Yeah.
But now, you know, even fat tires, you almost have to have studs because the ice is so bad the last couple of years.
Well, I mean, you haven't even needed a fat tire really in Anchorage for the last few years.
No.
Because
no, really. If I think last year, might have been the year before, we did have someone just on like a mountain bike with studded tires, and he did fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So when those bikes first started showing up, did you start seeing those racers just zooming ahead of everybody, and then the others start figuring out we better do that too?
Yeah, yeah. When the first fat tire bikes came, it was, and they were super expensive, so it was a little cost prohibitive for the average person. But yeah, you definitely saw that
You had to have one. Yeah, you couldn't.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, you know, this is also just an adventure. Not everybody's racing. There's a lot of people out there just for the camaraderie, just to see what they personally can do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we do have racers, but we have people that are just out to, you know, challenge themselves.
Yeah. So in terms of the skiing, we're not talking about Kincaid Park grooming here, right? We're talking about like snow machine trails, essentially.
True. We do have, we kind of help out with the Big Lake Trails Committee and the Willow Trails Committee, and they groom a lot of our course. So, and then we do some grooming. Martin Boozer, you know, he uses those trails for dog sledding, so he grooms some as well. But you can't guarantee that it will be groomed, but we do groom a lot of them. So they're pretty, and they're super well marked. We go out and we put probably 1,000 pieces of lath out there every quarter mile. So
wow.
It's difficult to get lost. We don't want anybody getting in trouble out there. But, so there is grooming. There is some, you know, open overflow sometimes. There's a little bit of river, so you can get just about anything. Right now, because there haven't had a lot of snow out there, it's pretty flat. Usually you get some really big moguls from all the snow machine traffic. But because there's not... the trails are really smooth.
Oh, well, that's nice. So,
not a flat course, mind you, but
right,
it's definitely smoother. It's not quite so many little moguls.
Those can really drive you crazy when you're trying to ski. So,
skiing, yes, and even biking, you're just up and down and up and down and up and down.
Do you still get as many skiers as you used to in the past?
No, sadly, and that's been always my struggle. I just want to see more and more skiers, but. It just depends on, I think they're out there. In fact, we've had a lot of skiers in the past that now have moved to bikes, but it just depends on how much training they get. You know, we just have had so little snow in Anchorage and the valley that it's hard. You know, like the White Mountains, that's a big ski race.
Right.
There's a lot more skiers, I think, than bikers there. So it just depends. I think this year we only have 17 skiers in the 100. But again, they can declare on race day. So you never know. Somebody might change their mind.
Yeah, it's this thing that I almost avoid thinking about it because I don't want to be bummed all the time, but so many skiers are kind of turning into cyclists because the skiing is just so bad for so long, you can't take it anymore. Yeah,
it's been quite a few years, hasn't mm-hmm. it? And that is, it's a bummer. Because a bike, you can just pretty much get on and leave from your house. We're skiing anymore, you've had to go into the mountains.
Yeah.
And then the foot people, they go everywhere. they are ones that amaze me, too, because they're towing a sled, you know, and the skiers, they either put it on their back. We have 15 pounds mandatory gear, so they either carry it on their back or a sled. Most of them do sleds. But
so what sort of skis do they mostly use? Using thick backcountry skis or racing skis? And I assume everybody classics. They wouldn't be able to skate.
No, actually, quite a few do skate.
Oh, really?
Fact,
wow.
A lot of them do. Because our trails are, there's not too many that aren't wide enough to skate.
Trails must be better than I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, they're pretty good. So, skating, of course, is faster. So
much faster.
Classic. But I don't think anybody uses the backcountry skis. I think they're pretty much...
Yeah, I was thinking more rugged conditions. So how many runners will you normally get?
Well, this year so far registered, we have 41.
All right.
And so out of 145, so about 28%.
And again, they probably are not going to win, but they could win among the runners, right? And a different person, you know, different sort of person? Or what's your the profile of somebody who wants to run 100 miles in the wintertime?
They're again amazing. You have the David Johnstons and the people like that are ultra marathoners, but we just have a lot of runners in Alaska, you know, a lot of mountain climbers and mm-hmm. A lot of ultra marathoners. I mean, there's just a large group of them, and they're kind of our staple people too that do that. We also offer a military scholarship. A lot of our racers generously donate, make a donation to our military scholarship. So we open a free entry for any Alaska-based military that want to compete. So every now and then we usually have four or five. This year not as many, but military that want to come do it. So a lot of them are on foot. You know, they're used to hiking you know, 50 miles with a backpack. So they come out and do this, and they usually do pretty well.
Huh, interesting. But when we talk about running, we're not talking about like the kind of running you'd see in a 5K. We're talking about you're pulling a sled and you're kind of trudging because you've got to cover 100 miles. You really have to pace yourself.
Right, right. And depending on the weather, you know, and the snow conditions, you know, if there's a lot of snow machine traffic, sometimes that chews up the trail. You know, if you could be post-holing a lot of it. So it just depends on the trail conditions. And if it's icy, you know, you're going to be running in cleats, which isn't maybe as fun as
sled,
but.
And do folks...
Always the weather.
Yeah, really. So do folks use snowshoes at all when the snow is deep?
They have in the past. We usually watch... like Laura McDonough, she is a ultra marathon woman. She's won the race before several times, I think. And we just kind of see what's Laura doing. Is Laura wearing her? Is she going to wear her snowshoes? But it doesn't happen very often. Again, just because we haven't had the big snow years. So some of the runners will carry them.
And then they will just be wearing like running shoes or boots or what do they wear? Do for footwear on these long races?
Running shoes. Yep, just running shoes. The ice bugs are real popular right now.
Mm-hmm.
So just anything that, you know, some people wear like boot type things, but pretty much running shoes, insulated running shoes.
We're talking about the Susitna 100 with Aaron Kittredge. It's a 100-mile race, and there's also a 50K sort of introductory version, which is going to be going out in a few days here from Big Lake. Aaron, what sort of dangers are out there that you talk to the competitors about? You said that you do have a mandatory safety meeting. Obviously, it's not the safest thing in the world to go and go 100 miles through the wilderness on your own, but you do have some backup. You have checkpoints and other runners coming along and cyclists. What sort of dangers do you worry about, and like what kind of accidents or problems have happened in the past?
Yeah, we've had a few broken bones. We've had a few people misplaced that have gotten off the trail. The course, like I said, we mark it really well. We also have snow machine support that, you know, we keep a pretty good eye on you. If you've, you know, checked into one checkpoint but haven't the other, and we've been watching your pace, we'll probably go out and take a look and make sure you didn't get off the trail. We require that you carry the safety gear, so if you need to bivvy because you're tired or cold or you've gotten hurt, that you can bivvy off the trail and we'll find you. Hypothermia is always frostbite, you know, just depending on the weather. But those are things we go over. We make sure all of our checkers are knowledgeable about that to see the signs of that. That's been the biggest thing. Like I said, a few broken bones. Those bikes, they go downhill really fast.
Yeah.
You know, depending on the terrain. We've got a couple nice hills that when you get down onto the river, those are a little challenging, and ice in years past too. So those would probably be the big hazards of just, I don't worry too much about people getting lost, knock on wood. I've never lost anybody for very long.
Uh-huh.
We do kind of keep an eye on things, but we've definitely had our share of broken bones and frostbite. And so we show a few of those horror pictures to make people really aware of how they layer, what gear they have, and to make them understand that's why we make them carry mandatory gear. You know, everybody throws that 20 below bag on their bike or in their sled and they're grumbling, but boy, all you need to do is need it once and you'll be happy we made you do it.
Yeah. Do you ever get people who enter who you just look at and think, wow, this person has never done anything remotely like this. This is a concern. Or do people, you know, has that ever happened? Or are people sort of smart enough to figure you don't really want to do this unless you know something?
I think we have had people we were a little concerned with, and I'll be darned if they didn't finish and finish fine. We had a military scholarship that showed up last year. He bought all his mandatory gear at the night of the check-in.
Oh, my gosh.
And his pack, I swear to goodness, probably weighed 50 pounds. And I thought, there is no way. And he made it all the way to mile 60. And he was just pushing his cutoff. But I would have never thought he'd make it that far. So
tough
again,
dude, huh?
Mental fortitude will get you a long way. Or people that had odd gear, you know. We have a lot of foreigners and a lot of people from other countries. And the language barrier is sometimes difficult. And they do fine, yeah. We have a very small evacuation, knock on wood. You know, we we don't evacuate too many people.
Mm-hmm.
Most people make it, or they drop out at a checkpoint, you know, and they're safe. But we don't have any, haven't had too many real concerns, because, like you said, you've got to do your research, and we have a lot of people ask questions. They'll send us email questions, and you know by the questions they're asking, you might be concerned about them. But at least they're asking the questions, right?
Yeah.
they're not going out thinking they know it all. They're asking, hey, what about this? Or, you know, and talk to other racers to know what gear works best or what they've tried and didn't work. Water, we do require that you carry mandatory water. And a lot of people like the Camelbacks. And if they've never gone out and used a Camelback
in
cold weather,
yeah,
they freeze. Some people do use them, but you just got to know how to keep the hose next to your body, how to have it insulated, how to blow out the hose when you're running.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are little tricks that they can talk to other people about. And we see that on our Facebook page. We ask people to, you know, pose questions to other racers. You'll get some opinions that are valuable. With this many rookie racers and this many veterans, they can pair up and compare notes.
Yeah, that's nice. It sounds like a kind of a good community thing where you've got lots of volunteers who are helping and you've got a community of racers who might be willing to sort of help each other out a little bit, not too cutthroat at all.
No, yeah. I've seen that race day. Somebody will walk up and say, what are you doing? That is, don't carry that. You'll never, ever use that, you know?
Uh-huh.
They're jettisoning things off their sled about last minute.
It sounds like a lot of fun, yeah.
And the competitive ones are competitive, but they're all still really happy. They're just out there with their friends, and they're having a good time just to see what they can do.
Well, and it's neat that you guys have done this for so many years and put it together as a nonprofit just to keep it going and have that event, and it must be a lot of work. So good thanks to you and to your family.
To our board, yeah. We just have phenomenal a board that's been around for a while, and we took the race. My husband and I took over race directing from the previous couple that actually had run it for years and years, and we just couldn't let it disappear, and the board decided to stay with us, and so it's been great, and just the volunteers that come out and enjoy it so much as well. So
fantastic. Well, thank you, Erin Kittredge. He's an organizer of the Susitna 100, which also includes the Little Sioux 50K, which is going to be taken off in just in a few days here. If you want to learn more about the race, you can check out our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show and you'll find links to Erin's race. Thanks so much for being with us, Erin.
Thank you, Charles. It was a pleasure.
So that's all for Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Eric Bork. Grace Bogene is our production assistant who lines up guests for us. My name's Charles Woolforth. Thanks for being with us. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.